This past year was not the first time that I felt afraid to sit in the sanctuary of my own synagogue. Growing up, my family was very involved in Temple Beth Am in the suburbs south of Boston. I was there in 1981 for Shabbat services on the October weekend after terrorists had burst into a bar mitzvah service at the main Vienna synagogue, throwing grenades and firing machine guns. My parents were on the bima or ushering because I remember clearly sitting by myself with a horrible, vivid image of our sanctuary riddled with bullets and bodies everywhere. I also remember how obsessed I was with the use of grenades at a bar mitzvah service, so destructive and unnecessarily beyond murderous. At 11 years old, I intuitively understood that was not just a mass murder. It was a pogrom, because it wasn't about killing. It was about the savagery and the malice against Jews. The wall of that childhood sanctuary was solid concrete with stained glass near the top. I knew every corner of that synagogue because I had felt so at home there. You couldn't see outside the wall, but I had never noticed the emergency exit built into it. I kept my eyes there, certain that that's where they would come in. This past October, almost 40 years later, I stood right here, literally in this very spot, and for the first time, I started the bar mitzvah service by pointing to the emergency exits in the sanctuary. I so appreciate the full glass walls of the sanctuary, because from here I can see straight to that hallway and straight to that hallway, and I'll see them coming. And maybe that few extra seconds would give enough of a warning to make a difference. Now, back in 1981, I was just a kid, but I think it's fair to say we believed that things that were happening in Europe could not happen here. This past year, with two anti-Semitic mass shootings, our perspective changed. There were two things that immediately surprised me about the Tree of Life shooting in Pittsburgh. One, it was a surprising confirmation. What a surprise that it had taken until 2018 for such a deadly attack on Jews in America to occur. The second surprise was, how did we not see this coming? How did we lose, as Barry Weiss writes, our instinct for danger? And then the shooting at the Poway, California Chabad Center on Passover confirmed it. It is time to wake up. The ADL report just a few months ago put a fine point on that news. The U.S. Jewish community experienced near historic levels of anti-Semitism in 2018, including a doubling of anti-Semitic assaults. One of the saddest truths to acknowledge about the rise of anti-Semitism is that it has revealed how deeply divided and distrustful we are of each other in the Jewish community. In the new year, I'm committed to fostering a higher degree of collectivity and mutual support in Jewish communal responses to anti-Semitism. Now, let's not over-romanticize a Jewish past where our ancestors rallied together and all Jews had each other's backs. History shows us that not even the Holocaust united Jews across lines of difference. The Warsaw Ghetto itself was riven with partisan divides, Orthodox and secular, Polish and New Russian immigrants, Zionists and internationalists. They were literally fighting each other for years before they could coalesce and create the ZOB, the Jewish Fighting Force, who resisted the Nazi liquidation of the ghetto in 43. The same was true in ancient days. The Hanukkah battle was sparked when one Jew rose to join a Hellenistic ritual, and another Jew, Matisyahu the priest, the father of the Maccabees, sprung from the crowd and killed him on the spot. So today's divisions are not new, but it's certainly not good. It's not good for the individual who experiences anti-Semitism and then suffers the double indignity of not being believed by their own community. It's also not good for the collective Jewish people when anti-Semites are emboldened by Jewish friends who give them cover. The threat to everyone's safety is worse when a fractured Jewish community draws its resources into smaller and smaller partisan silos. Then we are all less able to build and support institutions that strengthen Jewish life and the Jewish future, and we potentially do the anti-Semites' work for them. A more collectivist response to anti-Semitism is good for everyone. Now, the concepts of Jewish peoplehood, the idea that all Israel is responsible one for the other, is a traditional centerpiece of Judaism. But it's complicated. And the commitment to a united Jewish family has been weaker and weaker, especially today. I have argued myself against unconditional filial piety to all Jews. Just last Kol Nidre, you may recall, I urged us to consider our commitment to gender equality as important an obligation for us as an Orthodox community sees its commitment to gender separation, even if that meant we couldn't pray together on the holidays. Now, I still believe that as strongly as ever, but I would not urge anyone to dismiss the importance of Jewish peoplehood. One contemporary scholar named Yehuda Kurtzer from the Hartman Institute suggests re-embracing peoplehood in the face of today's anti-Semitism. He wrote, "The Jewish people have earned the right to take seriously our existential threats, our existential fears, and to have them taken seriously by others, especially by other Jews. As we commit to stand with each other in solidarity against anti-Semitism, we should also understand that all acts of anti-Semitism are not the same, and our response to them should not be equal. This past year, we hosted a professor from Hebrew University on Yom HaShoah named Amos Goldberg, who shared this idea with us. It's not enough to label something anti-Semitism. That label alone doesn't tell us anything meaningful and certainly doesn't help us formulate a response. For example, a swastika drawn in the past year in a school bathroom and the Auschwitz gas chambers are both manifestations of anti-Semitism. But they are so far different from each other, and the response we should mount to each one is so far different that it's barely helpful to say that they are both anti-Semitic and leave it at that. A common and effective tool for teaching about anti-Semitism and discrimination is publicized by the ADL, and it's called the Pyramid of Hate. The principle is that the most violent forms of anti-Semitism are the result of escalations from earlier less violent acts. So at the base of the pyramid are biased attitudes, stereotypes, and insensitive remarks. This is the broadest layer. It includes the most actions, but also entirely nonviolent. Now, each level up gets a little smaller and a little more dangerous. So the next level includes name-calling, bullying, and social avoidance. And then the next level from that is discrimination in policies like housing, job, and education discrimination. And then the next level above that is violent hate crimes, murder, assault, and vandalism. And then at the top of the pyramid is genocide. The lesson of the pyramid is to take anti-Semitism seriously at every level of incident. When we treat behaviors on the lower levels as acceptable, it creates an environment where anti-Semitism is normalized and escalations to greater violence emerge. But the stratification is also a clear reminder that there are levels of difference. Taking anti-Semitism, quote, seriously, doesn't mean taking it all the same. We have to be much more thoughtful than to treat a middle school swastika the same as a murder. Likewise, we can't tolerate the low-level anti-Semitism on the basis of something like no blood, no foul. It's going to be complicated sometimes, but we need to prepare ourselves to handle that. As we try to balance an outward-looking universalism, one common response, with the need to protect ourselves, another common response, we encounter real-life decision points without easy black-and-white answers. And I believe there are three overlapping dynamics that, in combination, challenge our ability to come together effectively against the rise of anti-Semitism. Our visiting professor, Amos Goldberg, described the first dynamic like this. There is a growing tendency among both Jews and non-Jews to label people with whom they disagree politically as anti-Semitic, a severe accusation that often renders them illegitimate in the public arena. Politics is like an increasingly competitive sport. And in an era of constant campaign cycle, politicians must consistently work to defeat their opponents. Now, we all know that the weaponization of outrage about anti-Semitism has become a tool of choice in that competition. And that, in turn, makes us doubt the integrity of some accusations of anti-Semitism. As a result, we may be as likely to dismiss another Jew's cry of anti-Semitism as we are to support them, depending almost entirely on their political position or the person they've accused. The second dynamic is a tendency to conflate the layers of the pyramid into one single demon called anti-Semitism, to which there is then only one legitimate response: destroy it. The third dynamic is an overwrought insistence on Jewish solidarity and unity, even as that unity is demonstrably weakening. The result of this dynamic is that a Jew who disagrees with applying the anti-Semitic label to a person or a situation is seen then as not just blind or foolish, but by separating themselves from the community, as defined by the accusers, they are worse than capos, to use Ambassador Friedman's term. Now, here's where it gets even more complicated. When talking about anti-Semitism today, Trump-era politics is the elephant in the room. Trump's remarks over the summer that Jews who vote Democratic are disloyal is a stunning example. But this is not just about Trump. Let's go back to the controversy earlier this year that surrounded Representative Ilhan Omar, a Muslim, freshman congresswoman, a Somali refugee from Minneapolis. In a few different tweets, she used classic anti-Semitic stereotypes when talking about Israel and American politics. Jews had the world hypnotized. Jewish money controlled the system. And dual loyalty was at play. Now, President Trump and many Republicans had already bitterly attacked her and other Democratic freshmen, mostly women of color, in the squad. The attacks at times were racist, misogynistic, and inappropriate. There seems to be a broad political strategy at work: amplify everything about Ilhan Omar so loudly that she will be seen as the face of the entire Democratic Party, then launch a concerted attempt to discredit her in any way possible, to destroy her career, and thereby damage and destroy the larger party too. Now, in a world that refuses to allow for different levels of response to anti-Semitic actions, people concerned about anti-Semitism are forced in a situation like that to start only with the end in mind, an overly strident response to a lower level action on that pyramid. Join us in destroying her, or consider yourself a traitor and an apologist for all anti-Semitism. So when charges of anti-Semitism erupted, many liberals, including Jews, were loath to accept the label. Many rushed to defend Representative Omar from Islamophobia and from Trump's signature disparagement of foreigners and refugees especially. Now, because of these overlapping dynamics, many of those defenders simply refused to see that Omar's remarks did fall somewhere on that pyramid of hate, even if it's that lowest level of using anti-Semitic stereotypes. Now, that we could pick lots of other figures, but the same is certainly true in an even greater way with Trump himself. His defenders no doubt believe he is not an anti-Semite. His critics are certain that his stereotyping of Jews and his encouragement of white supremacists are responsible for the rise in anti-Semitism. They will accept nothing short of Trump's destruction, meaning his immediate removal from office, or at a minimum, his imminent defeat. The divided and fraught politics make it hard for either side to see any integrity in legitimate claims of anti-Semitism by the other side. Battle lines are drawn within the Jewish community, and each side accuses the other of bad faith. Meanwhile, as we debate and attack each other over which public figure is or is not an anti-Semite, the truly dangerous perpetrators of hate descend on the streets of Charlottesville and storm sanctuaries filled with Jewish worshipers. So what are we supposed to do? Throughout Jewish history, there have been two main responses. One response is to circle the wagons, strengthen our ability to defend ourselves. This was the deliverance in the Purim story. After Mordechai and Esther gained some power to stop Haman, the story ends like this, quoting, "The Jews gathered themselves together in their cities, and no person could withstand them. They struck their enemies, destroying them, and doing to their enemies as the enemies had planned to do to the Jews." In 2003, in a modern example, the Israeli Air Force joined the official Polish Holocaust remembrance at Auschwitz by flying attack jets piloted by the offspring of Holocaust survivors over the remnants of the camp. Now swooping over the infamous railroad gate to the camp and tilting a bit to show the bombs on their underside, the lead pilot was broadcast over the radio, promising in the name of the 6 million, quote, "to be the shield of the Jewish people against any future anti-Semitic violence." Now, if you've never seen it, you should Google Eagles over Auschwitz. The photos from that event continue to stand as one of the most striking images of what never again actually looks like. Though we're not a tradition steeped in violence, Judaism says self-defense is a mitzvah. Now there's another main response, historically, to anti-Semitism. That is to embrace universalism and join the fight against hatred and bigotry in every form, to make more friends and more allies. Perhaps the best statement of this principle, it's not Jewish, but it comes from Reverend Martin Niemöller, who wrote during the Holocaust, "First they came for the socialists, and I didn't speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me." I couldn't be more proud of the sustained and deep efforts that our congregation has made to speak out for other people and to stand for those around the world in this past year. Our gun violence prevention program just won a national award for its work, including a close partnership with the cathedral. Sinai House continuously helps formerly homeless families to gain independence regardless of their background. Project Mensch brings everything from books to food to poor children, many of whom are recent immigrants. And when a family of asylum seekers from Congo arrived here just a few months after Pittsburgh, we had one member drive to Richmond in the middle of the night to pick them up. Another offered a house rent-free. Others became their translators, close advisors, began tutoring their kids. Doctors from our congregation opened their practices. An immigration lawyer gave dozens of hours to prepare their work and literally walk them through the ICE check-in procedure over 2 days. All of this happened in those very same months after Pittsburgh and Poway. We should be proud to see how our congregation lives that core Jewish response. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Do not stand idly by. Do not oppress or wrong the stranger. It is possible to find verses that support only a tribal inward focus. But it's also impossible to find the fullness of Judaism without opening our hearts and our homes to others and without the imperative to help anyone who's oppressed. And there's a third important response to anti-Semitism. lift up your inner Jewish voice. Deborah Lipstadt talks about being a subject and not an object. The best response to the past year is not to allow your Jewish identity to be an object of someone else's imagination, especially not an anti-Semite's. Rather, make yourself and your Judaism the subject of your own greater engagement. Barry Weiss, in her book, boils it down to this: the Jews did not sustain their magnificent civilization because they were anti-Semites. Our tradition was always renewed by people who made the choice in the face of tragedy that theirs would not be the end of the story, but the catalyst for writing a new chapter. The long arc of Jewish history makes it clear that the only way to fight is by waging an affirmative battle for who we are. Now, it's pretty trite for the rabbi to stand up on Yom Kippur and tell you to come to temple more often. But you should come to temple more often. I want you to come because, frankly, it's just more fun when there's more people here, but we are bursting at the seams with opportunities. Judaism and classes we teach on so many subjects. You could check out a book here. You can play Mahjong. You can go to a Sinites youth event like the Dinners Out in the neighborhood. Adult theater outings, volunteer with us on Shabbat at a wider circle, etc., etc. And at the risk of doubling the triteness, Rabbi Yisrael Goldstein, the Chabad rabbi who was shot in Poway, agreed when he wrote the next day, "Today should have been my funeral. I don't know God's plan. All I can do is try to find meaning in what has happened. A reminder, most of all, to never, ever, not ever be afraid to be Jewish. We are a people divinely commanded to bring God's light into the world. That," he said, "is what I pledge to do with my borrowed time." As for me, I'm certain that this past year will not be the last time that I feel afraid in the sanctuary of my own synagogue. Like that childhood temple, I've come to feel very much at home in this building. I think I know every corner of it, including now the location of every panic button and every path to safety out of every door in the sanctuary, Beit Am, and classroom. But I'm honestly not keeping my eyes on the emergency exits anymore. I'm entering 5780 with a renewed understanding of the importance of Jewish peoplehood. I won't be a blind loyalist to the tribe over any and all principle, but I embrace the idea that each of us is responsible in times of danger for every other member of our community. We also must keep our vigilance high and be ready to respond, as Mordechai did to Haman. Meanwhile, we must also continue to reach out in love, friendship, and trust to our neighbors in the larger community. We must lift up the fallen, clothe the naked, and keep faith with those who sleep in the dust. And most pointedly, in the coming year, we must rise above the standard political strategies of this time. I'm going to step out on a limb. Politics is not my business, like it literally is for many people in this room. But before I conclude, I'm going to talk directly to you. You probably didn't create this current model of politics in which labeling opponents as anti-Semites is a go-to part of a candidate's strategy. It's an increasingly ubiquitous move on both the left and the right. And you may feel like you have no choice but to run with it. But in fact, you have significant power to influence how the game, so to speak, is played. Using anti-Semitism as a political weapon should be taken out of your playbooks, and you should push your colleagues and your clients to do the same. If you think that it's the only way for your candidate to win, your candidate probably needs better policies, or a better wardrobe, or a dozen other things better. If you think you have some kind of obligation to do anything possible to destroy the opponent, remember these words from Mordechai to Esther, quoting from chapter 4. "Do not imagine that you, of all the Jews, will escape with your life by being in the king's palace. On the contrary, if you keep silent in this time of crisis, relief and deliverance for the Jews will have to come from another place." "Who knows," Mordechai said, "maybe you achieved your high position for just such a crisis. Everyone's got a role to play in fighting anti-Semitism, but yours is particularly pressing. And for all of us, most importantly, we must heed the voice that calls inside us. Our Jewish neshama wants attention. Our connection to Jewish history, people, and traditions is heightened. Let us use this awakening to build a world that is better, stronger, more full of love, peace, and light in the year to come. Gemar Chatima Tovah.